understand how a child works and what makes a child in a way or another.
Right.
Now, the first thing we need to understand about our children, that we have to understand that children, especially at a younger age, some of them, if not all of them, they have a talent, right?
Right.
Now, with kids and their talents, it's different than their skills. Sometimes with a skill, it's a God-given gift, a skill, right? So, for example, a child might be, you know, very smart at maths and physics and all these things, and
right.
from a young age you can tell this guy is very smart and he's very skillful at a particular thing. And sometimes, no, kids, they just have talents when it comes to things, right? For example, they could be talented at singing. They could be talented at dancing. I don't know. They could be talented at
football.
A craft, football, sports. They could have these kind of talents. Now, as parents, first and foremost, when we look at our children, we have to see what they like. What do they want, right? And
with
the thing with talents as well that we need to keep in mind is that keeps changing. So one day he might be good at drawing. Tomorrow he could be doing something else. As parents, one of the things that we need to work with the talents. We need to give them enough time to work with the talent, increase their talent, and enjoy it. Because sometimes when we deal with kids, we try to make them do what we want them to do.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
For example, if the child is, you know, let's say he loves games. He loves PlayStation games and stuff like that. And I see it as a bad thing. And I try to prevent him from it.
Right.
Now, I am literally trying to put a lock on a child, which is going to cause you a lot of problems. So, instead of going against the current, as we say, try to go with the current, right? So, if I see he's talented, for example, at games, I need to give him games that work his mind, games that could be more creative, stuff like that. So, whatever talent he has, I need to work with that.
But also, one should be very careful not to stress their child, because we've seen this with parents who have a talented child who's very good at football or some other kind of sport, like playing the piano, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they suddenly start to expect and demand from them some achievements that they themselves want to subconsciously achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes so stressful for the child that in the end, the child stops loving that hobby that they show so much joy before.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Detrimental to the child's development, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, that's what I'm saying. So, we need to understand that a talent, as a talent, it could stay, it could go.
Right.
Don't turn it into a skill. Right? So, people, for example, with parents, like you said, my son might have a good voice, and I try to pressure him to be a musician, for example, a singer.
Right.
It's not his skill. It's not something that he wants. See, now he's enjoying it, but later on, maybe he doesn't want to continue that kind of path in life. He has something else. So don't turn it into a skill. Leave it as a hobby. You know, now this is what he likes. I go with it. I try to work with it. I try to, I don't know, at least
encourage it.
Encourage
it,
or try to, I don't know, put it into frames.
Right.
You know, give him the required tools and means to make sure that this talent is, or this hobby of his, is taking place naturally without any problems.
Dear Sayyid, I must unfortunately interrupt you because we are going on a quick break.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are speaking about how important talents are for children and how important it is that they stay that way. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us even further.
The first thing that we need to keep in mind that with kids, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given them talents and giving them skills that we need to, at least from a young age, we need to pay attention to that fact.
Right.
That we need to work with their skills, work with their talents, and try to, at least make it grow, at least try to encourage it, at least try to let them have that space where they could work with themselves. And sometimes understanding such a point when it comes to talent, it could help parents a lot when it comes to connecting and dealing with the children. So when you, for example, me as a father, you know, my son loves games. He right. loves to play PlayStation games and computer games. Sometimes I sit next to him and I play with him. And to him, it's such a great joy. He feels a lot of pride in himself to see that, for example, his father is playing with him
right.
and enjoying the game. And not just that, he knows about the game because
it
sometimes
means so much, and
yeah.
they will never forget that.
Exactly.
Children.
So sometimes it creates this gap between the parents and the kids when it comes to the talents that the parents could not relate to,
right.
and the child sees himself being isolated in the house. But for example, if a mother herself is into art, and she comes and does artwork with her children. For example, my wife, she always does artwork with my kids, with the girls, and they have a very special relationship with each other.
Right.
Because they're constantly spending time together, they're constantly working with the things they both like. So right. it makes the relationship between the parents and the children such a strong bond
right.
that it becomes like almost like when I look at my kids, for example, it's almost like a friendship relationship
right.
rather than a father or a mother relationship.
Yeah, friends sitting enjoying whatever they're
exactly.
enjoying as a hobby.
Exactly. And as the child grows, he grows having that trust in his parents, having that confidence in his parents that he can come to them and talk to them and everything else. At the same time, when the parents themselves, they work with kids and their talents and their gifts and their hobbies, it also eliminates having the parents to deal with bad friends as well. Because sometimes, let's say, if my child is not playing with me, for example, he would go online and he would play with kids around the world.
Right.
And you don't know who these people are. I mean, sometimes I sit with my brothers who play online games and they play with people from different countries.
Right,
and
right.
some of these people, not even Muslims, to say the least. And
to say the very least.
Yeah, and
most
they
of them
say
are some
things, you know, very offensive, very rude, very bad things.
If any of our listeners have ever played
yeah.
an online game, they understand. An
online
competitive
exactly.
online game.
Gamers, they would understand this.
Yeah.
So
no question.
I mean, when I look at that, I say, well, that's not a good thing. You know,
no,
that's really distractive. So a child would prefer himself to have one of his parents play with him, for example, or encourage him or do things with him
right.
that, you know, creates this bond and eliminates.
It's a safe space.
Yeah, and eliminates that danger that you could be facing from elsewhere. So this point itself, when it comes to understanding a child, first, when you look at a child, see what he likes and what he dislikes. That's the first thing as parents we need to pay attention to, because sometimes we just don't know. We
right.
think that whatever they do is because they have to do it or because they're just wasting time. Sometimes no, it's something that they actually take seriously. And some of the kids these days, when it comes to their talents and to their hobbies, they want to make it known. They want people to see it. So for
right.
example, people even now with kids, they do something and they put it on YouTube. And you see how many YouTubers, mashallah, we have these days
yep.
with kids.
Or on
right?
Facebook.
Yeah, when we, you know. So kids, they just like to record what they do and post it to the entire world to seek recognition.
Right.
So why should I put my child in this case, in this situation, where as a parent, I could look at his hobbies and I could work with him and give him the recognition that he seeks?
They say, unfortunately, our time for today's session is up. Thank you, dear Sayyid, for your insightful knowledge. I also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If our listeners had any questions or other relevant feedback, they may find us on our various social media accounts, such as on Instagram and on YouTube and Facebook, under the call sign of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the vision of the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Among the things that we mentioned that Amir al-Mu'mineen really wanted to create under an Islamic government is the political and social security that people needs to have. In this regard, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he refuses for any human being or anyone to intimidate any other human being by being in a position of authority, regardless of this position, be it in society or even the authority of a father, the authority of a husband, whatever authority, even the authority of a clergyman, and you move on, a president, a person, a department. Intimidation and trying to scare other people is one of the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, especially through means of authority, he tried to stood against fiercely, to the extent he says, لا يحل لمسلم أن يروع مسلما. It is not allowed or not permissible for a Muslim to intimidate another Muslim. That's how far he would go. You have no right whatsoever to intimidate any other human being, yet alone a Muslim brother who lives with you in the same system, for example. Likewise, he says, "Man nadhara," that's, he goes even further. He says, whoever looks at a mu'min, at a believer, just to scare him off. Sometimes you don't do anything to scare him off. Sometimes you just give him the stare of death, as we call it. Just staring at a mu'min to scare him. He says, أَخَافُهُ اللَّهُ يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. Allah on Day of Judgment will scare that person. So he says that under no circumstances should you scare a person, intimidate them to begin with, or even to look at them with that look to scare them off. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he shifts his ideology to something else, to the authority, which is the most important authority that obviously in within a system that governs a society. And then he gives an example of an authoritarian system, which is the Umayyad dynasty. And he says that's how they dealt with people, obviously, in their time. And we have systems who are also Umayyad dynasty and then nature, but with a different name. He says they made people, they made people's life miserable. They drove them violently, and they crunched them the cup of just having to be patient. And he says, and they would give them the sword, and they would, you know, clothe them with fear. That's the authority of Bani Umayyah. And this is an authority that continues even in our day time. But obviously with a different name, with a different slogan, with a different cover, but it's always the same. So Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah says the authorities are responsible over their people, and they should not scare them like the Umayyad people did. Let us take a short break, and then inshallah we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi, through having or wanting to create a safe and secure environment for human beings, he considered that to be the best of actions. So he says, فَمَنْ آمَنَ خَائِفًا آمَنَهُ اللَّهُ مِنْ إِقَابِهِ. He who saves a person and grants him security or gives him security, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the day of judgment will give him safety and security. So Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah alayhi, even he goes further and he says, شَرُّ الْبِلَادِ بَلَدٌ لَا أَمْنَ فِيهِ. This is the worst of countries, the worst of places to stay in, is a place where there is no safety. If you are not safe in your own country, for example, or in your own place that you live in, then life itself loses its meaning. So that's why Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi, he was trying to direct and shift the attention of people to look after one another. That I need to give security to those around me, and those around me need to give security to me and to them, to those people around them. And then we will have a beautiful, secure, safe society to live in. And from here it was commanded that whoever helps a person feel safety and security, Allah in return will give him that safety and security in the day of judgment. To the extent he says, لا نعمة أهنأ من الأمن. There is no blessing that Allah has bestowed on a person more pleasurable than the blessings of security, having that safety. Because you could have wealth, you could have food, you could have a house, you can have a lot of things, but if there's no safety, none of them would matter. And you can see that in many countries, people, for example, they own businesses, they own houses, they own land, but then a terrorist group comes along and they leave everything behind and they flee. They flee with their own clothes, and you can see that in many countries. Currently, you know, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and all these countries that are ravaged by war. Many people have wealth, they have property, they have so many things that we consider to be rich. But if there is no safety, there is no security, then there is nothing, you know, there's no point of it. So when he says, La na'ma ahna'u min al-amn, there is no blessing better than safety, is truly correct. It cannot be more precise, more correct from Amir al-Mu'mineen. So Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi, throughout his life, he was trying to create that sense of security, that sense of safety for people so they could live a happier life, they could live a better life, so they could direct their attention to the more important things, which is to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to gain their akhirah and to create a better world for themselves in the hereafter. Otherwise, they will be too busy trying to survive, trying to live, when the rights are taken, when they are constantly being threatened. This is just a short vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi that we can take when it comes to human rights. Inshallah, we will continue looking at more of Amir al-Mu'mineen's vision towards human rights in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Tah al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim arjuka ahsin khatmina.
In the limelight.
Shocking instances of sexual and physical abuse of asylum seekers at the southern U.S. border by federal officers have been uncovered by Human Rights Watch. After a years-long battle to wrestle information from the Department of Homeland Security under freedom of information laws. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Christian Spencer Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Report Shows Shocking Abuses by Asylum Seekers by U.S. Border Agents. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. People seeking asylum in the U.S. have alleged in more than 100 cases that were physically and sexually abused by U.S. Border Patrol agents, according to a new report by Human Rights Watch released recently. Human Rights Watch unearthed information from the Department of Homeland Security under the Freedom of Information Act, finding more than 160 cases of misconduct and abuse by leading government agencies between 2016 and 2021, notably from Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and Border Patrol agents. The group wrote, the FOI documents paint the picture of DHS as an agency that appears to have normalized shocking abuses at the U.S. borders. Some of these cases include child sexual assault, starvation, threats of rape, and brutal detention conditions. The records are also heavily redacted, according to the nonprofit. In one report, an asylum officer in San Francisco notified superiors about a young child who was sexually molested by someone we believe to be CBP or Border Patrol officer. The young girl was forced to undress and touched inappropriately by a guard wearing green. The Border Patrol uniform is green. One case claims in 2018, a male asylum seeker detained and taken to a detention center in San Ysidro, California, was told by a male CBP agent if he gave him sex, he would be set free. The detainee did not accept the offer, and the officer swore at him in English and said he would be locked up as punishment, according to documents. Human Rights Watch says the records it obtained do not show whether any of the reports of abuse were investigated or if any disciplinary action was taken. The records show that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services employees were confused about the proper reporting procedures, and asylum officers received reports with alarming evidence of misconduct. accusations of misconduct and mistreatment by federal agents toward migrants and asylum seekers have long been documented at detention centers, also referred to by detainees as hirulars, or ice boxes for how cold they are, The Guardian reports. I was there for 10 days sitting. I couldn't move because it was 67 of us in that cell. We said we needed toilet paper and water, and we reported the animals, the scorpions in there. A Honduran asylum seeker set of conditions in the McAllen facility in 2019, according to the documents. There were scorpions, and sticks, fleas, and they would tell us that it was fine. It was because of our own stink of being there 45 days, unquote. Concerns about inappropriate behavior by American officers at the border made international headlines again in September when Border Patrol agents on horseback bearing what looked like whips were photographed grabbing at Haitian migrants. The Human Rights Watch documents point to numerous ways in which asylum seekers appear to have had the right to due process violated. One of the records released in the Freedom of Information suit appears to relate to a federal inquiry into CBP and Immigration and Customs Enforcement IC violations of correct procedure. The inquiry found 27 possible cases where asylum seekers were blocked from filing complaints or forced to sign papers they could not understand. One Honduran man applying for asylum was told by a Border Patrol agent that unless he signed paperwork rescinding his application, he was going to be sent to jail where they were going to rape him.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Friday, Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probe into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shataya called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Azam Qasem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violent international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has warned against any of its independence bids. Tensions escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reported that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S., too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long curtailed Taipei in an attempt to unnerve Beijing. The United States, which backs Taipei's separatist president, also continues to sell weapons to the island in defiance of Beijing and in violation of its own official policy.
What they call a strategic ambiguity in American policy. They like to keep Taiwan as in some kind of de facto independent status, but they have recognized de jure that it's one country and Taiwan is a part of China.
China has also denounced the recently clinched AUKUS pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., under which the trio is expected to make a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Beijing argues that the pact threatens regional stability and poses nuclear proliferation risks. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foil their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity. as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran, is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S. The face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government had decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, the United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue under in this situation? But what needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new, the U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The dire consequences of climate change we are now experiencing could have been avoided if Total executives 50 years ago had decided that the future of the planet is more important than their profits, says Jessica Corbett, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Bombshell, Total knew about climate threat from fossil fuels for decades, but denied it. Stay tuned for more. Shell knew, it turns out Total knew too. The French oil major rebranded to Total Energies earlier this year knew 50 years ago that fossil fuels threatened the global climate and responded by denying science in pursuit of profit, according to research published recently in the peer-reviewed journal Global Environment Change. The bombshell study from three historians, which follows similarly damning exposés of ExxonMobil in 2015 and Royal Dutch Shell in 2017, comes as fossil fuel giants face growing legal efforts around the world to make polluters pay for their significant contributions to the climate emergency. Based on interviews and company records, the historians found that Total personnel received warnings of the potential for catastrophe from its products by 1971, became more fully informed of the issue in 1980s, began promoting doubt regarding the scientific basis for global warming by late 1980s, and ultimately settled on a position in late 1990s of publicly accepting climate science while promoting policy delay or policies peripheral to fossil fuel control. The trio also found that Exxon, through the International Petroleum Industry Environmental Conservation Association, IPIECA, coordinated an international campaign to dispute climate science and weaken international climate policy beginning in 1980s. Co-author Christophe Bonnet, a historian at France's National Center for Scientific Research, told Agence France-Presse that we thought that only Exxon and the U.S. oil and gas giants were engaged in this kind of duplicity. Now we know that French majors also participated in this, at least between 1987 and 1994, Bonnet said. Spokesperson for Total told AFP that the company openly acknowledged the findings of climate science 25 years ago, as well as the link with the petroleum industry, and Total Energies finds it regrettable to be called out for a situation from 50 years ago without highlighting the efforts, changes, progress, and investments made since then. However, the study does detail some of the company's more recent behavior. By late 1990s, the French petroleum industry shifted away from openly disputing climate science, but continued to expand its investments in upstream oil and gas production and employed rhetorical strategies that emphasized uncertainty, downplayed urgency, and deflected attention away from fossil fuels as the primary cause of global warming. By mid-2000s, the merged entity Total intensified its efforts to build scientific credibility, endorsing the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and hosting a conference on climate change. The company began to promote a division of roles between science and business, in which science describes climate change and business claims to solve it, reinforcing its claim to legitimacy in determining appropriate public and corporate policies. This framing enables Total to portray itself as a socially responsible petroleum company by wrapping continued investments in fossil fuel production in an attractive energy transition narrative. Climate campaigners responded to the revelations with calls for governments and the global financial sector to force TotalEnergies to align with the Paris Climate Agreement by preventing new fossil fuel projects. The advocacy organizations 350.org and Notre Frère Atout launched a new campaign. These revelations provide proof that TotalEnergies and the other oil and gas majors have stolen the precious time of a generation to stem the climate crisis, the group said in a joint statement. The dire consequences of climate change we are now experiencing could have been avoided if Total executives 50 years ago had decided that the future of the planet is more important than their profits. Justin Repo, campaign manager for Notre Affaire Atout, one of the groups using the courts to hold the French government accountable for climate inaction, noted that legal frameworks and lawsuits are proving to be more and more effective in forcing multinationals to respect their climate commitments, as demonstrated by the case of Shell in the Netherlands. But we must be vigilant. These legal initiatives are under constant attack from the lobbies of big business, as we are currently seeing with the EU Corporate Due Diligence and Accountability Initiative, or the UN Binding Treaty on Transnational Corporations, Repo added. Clemence Dubois, 350.org France's team lead, asserted that the intensive development of new oil and gas projects is a declaration of war against humanity. Total's plans to continue developing massive new oil and gas fields in the years to come could end up costing millions of lives, Dubois warned. This is only possible, though, because of the support they receive from the financial sector. From all over the world, we are appealing to the banks. It is time to cut funding to Total. Notre Affaire Atout and 350.org's campaign includes a website featuring a petition that calls on CEOs of the commercial banks that finance Total and its projects to stop immediately. The Total new website explains that campaigners are targeting banks rather than going after Total directly because we don't want their empty promises and fossil fuel giants need investments and project funding to keep their dirty oil and gas business going. The Total expose was published less than 2 weeks